Hello and welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. This is episode 161. I'm your humble host, Jonathan Metz, and with me today, James Jones.
Stay sexy.
John Lindemann.
Bring it.
Greg Leahy.
Ahoy, hoy, everyone.
And you, the listener. We're so glad to have you here. We've got an exciting show here. We're going to be talking about our most anticipated Wii and DS games for the fall, you know, the holiday season. And of course, we've got your listener mail to wrap up the show, and we'll start off with new business in just a sec. But I do want to mention real quick, and this probably should go at the end of the show, but whatever. We are going to take a vacation next week, so don't freak out when you don't get your episode after this one. We need a break, especially Greg, and I believe it has something to do with, like, NFL season openers, and I don't know.
Has to do with Brett Favre.
But it does.
Has cracked ribs.
Yeah. We're just going to have a very temporary retirement from
But speaking of football, actually, James has a bit of the pigskin in the
start.
New business.
Ooh. Well, we're recording this on Thursday, so college football started about 2 hours and 48 minutes ago.
And who's playing in the opener?
South Carolina and NC State, which is currently at 7-3 with 3:28 left in the fourth quarter.
This is the only time of the year I wish I had cable.
Fully attentive in this episode, by the sound of it.
So for the past few weeks, I've been, what's the word for it, hankering.
Jonesing?
Yes.
So
last Friday, I went and I tried to cool the needs by grabbing NCAA Football 9, which is the last year's iteation.
So as opposed to paying
$60 for the game, I paid $15.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, like, they can't have the players anyway, right?
See,
the thing is, I mean, it doesn't matter. As long as it has Tim Tebow, it doesn't matter.
You can download a fully complete, 100% accurate roster for all 120 FBS teams that somebody sat there and made. It's amazing.
It seems like the trick with the college football games is they really have to work harder to differentiate 1 year's edition from the next because they don't come with roster updates like Greg.
Well, see, I actually played a demo of 2010 today just to see if there's a difference. And it's presentational difference mostly. Like, I was able to go from 2009, call the exact same plays I was calling in 2009, and they looked exactly the same.
Yeah.
But, like, there's these, they do, like, camera tricks and stuff, like the wire camera mid-play, or they'll rotate the camera as you're going, give you a better angle.
Mm-hmm.
So that was kind of nice. But if you'll note, I mentioned this a long time ago. I had 2003, I think, back for the GameCube.
Yeah.
I put hundreds of hours into that game because I could play it pretty mindlessly. And first off, this game is a lot harder than that one. The AI is much, much better. So they'll jump routes now. You could throw all over the field before. You were like football Jesus before. You threw the ball, and as long as your receiver was in the remotely correct area, bam! Caught.
Isn't football Jesus kind of redundant?
Well, a little bit, but you were the Jesus of football.
Oh, yeah.
Touchdown Jesus, maybe.
You turned interceptions into touchdowns, basically.
Man. It was,
instead of water into wine.
It was a work of genius, and your cornerbacks literally had, like, magnets in their hands. So I'd just be like, oh, I picked it off.
So they've improved it over the course of, like, 7 years, you're saying.
And what worries me here is, as I'm listening to the calls, I'm like, these calls sound familiar. They're using the exact same recorded play calls that they used back in 2003.
That's terrible.
not the same script. These are the exact same recordings. And I guess they've added a few since then. But, like, I'm hearing the same play calls. Like, oh, I've not seen hits like that since. And then somebody's like, don't say it, coach. And it's like, this is the same shit.
Awful.
And these are professional football announcers. This is what is it? Lee Corso and
Corso's terrible. Corso
Herb Street.
They shouldn't have those guys doing it because, I mean, those guys don't do play-by-play.
No, they don't.
They do college game day, right?
Yeah, but those are like halftime shows, basically.
Yeah, they're
analyst
shows.
They will do, like, Herb Street does play-by-play on off days, like Tuesdays and Wednesdays when they have games. But, yeah, he doesn't do play-by-play that much.
Yeah.
And
isn't Corso the one that puts on the mask as a team picks?
Corso's an idiot.
So it's very weird that they didn't re-record that stuff, but
can't get them in the same room together anymore.
Well, what they did improve massively, even over, like, the recent sports games I've played, is how the whole recruiting engine, where now it's very much you have to learn how your potential recruits react to certain topics of discussion, what they want to see when they do visits and stuff like that.
Oh, there's only one topic of discussion the recruits really care about.
John, would you like to make a joke about the University of Miami now?
No, they pretty much are a joke now.
It's cold, man.
So,
ice
James,
cold.
I mean, do you find that these games really scratch your itch for college football? To me, they don't attract me. I mean, I'm a huge college football fan, as you know, and I've never been, you know...
A little bit. A lot of what makes college football great is the environment.
Mm-hmm.
The energy on... It's not, you know, guys going out there to play for money, although they are playing for money in the end.
Yeah, they are.
But can you really translate that atmosphere into a video game?
Well, kind of. So you get...
Like if you get really
drunk.
It feels
very different than an NFL game.
Yeah.
So they make a good show... Like, this game has ESPN branding on it, officially. So they make a very concerted effort to make it look like an ESPN...
broadcast, yeah.
Yeah, and in what I saw from 2010 in the brief demo, they do an even better job of that, including the addition of Miss Erin Andrews, which is a requirement for any ESPN broadcast of any merit. But, you know, I think that's how they differentiate themselves from the NFL versions of the games. Now they try to make it closer to the environment. So they'll pay more attention to the crowd, the mascots, the individual quirks of different teams' home fields.
They got all the fight songs and the bands.
I think there's like 280 situational fight songs in the game.
Hmm.
So, you know, a lot of teams have 2-3 fight songs depending on what happens. So they go and they get all that right, you know. The scary thing is that playing the previous game and then this one is that now I can hear like the first 4 notes of a fight song and I'm like, I know what school that is. Which is a disturbing ability to have.
Fight songs are so awesome. They're the worst songs ever written. I mean, the words to them are...
Hold that tiger for Clemson is the worst song ever written.
It's pretty bad.
Hold that tiger. Nice.
Yes, that is the fight song.
I would never partial to the pro ones like Hail to the Redskins.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it doesn't make any sense at the pro level. It really doesn't.
Yeah.
So, you know, I give the series a lot of credit for trying to get stuff in there like that. You know, this is how the game is different. And, you know, a lot of the Madden games do these wide-angle shots for the play, except for the Wii one, for various reasons. But in the college game, they actually do the camera work closer to what an ESPN broadcast is, which is very different than an NFL broadcast. The angles they choose and the height of the camera and the zoom, I mean, if you're just casually watching, you probably wouldn't pick it up, but it is different. So, I mean, you know, it doesn't completely satiate my desire for college football, but it gets me through the week between games.
Do you have any theories as to why this game has not shown up on Wii?
I thought there was one.
It did once, didn't it?
It did.
And then it was never heard from again.
I know it's not this year.
It just didn't sell. This is what happened on the GameCube, where they brought it 2 or 3 seasons, and it just kept bombing.
It just seems like they just kind of keep poking at the Nintendo platform, and they never commit to it. And certainly on Wii especially, I mean, if you look at what EA's done with Madden, which is the sister or the brother series to NCAA, it just seems like they've shown so much more effort and initiative with Madden and trying to make it work on Wii.
I don't know whether it's as facile as just it's not the big console in dorms or whatever. I mean,
yeah,
it could be. I mean, that could really be it.
Because Xbox and PS3 are bound to be way bigger at dorms than we, or at least from their point of view.
Could be.
It's just how much money they wanted to dump into it, really. I mean, they dumped a lot of money into that Madden Wii game. And from what I played at E3, neither Nick nor I could really get a handle on it.
Yeah, but Neil gave it a really, really high review score.
Yeah.
And I've seen pretty positive reviews.
Yeah,
of the
it just
Wii
seems like
Madden.
It's less muddled about its identity now, basically. You know, mm-hmm. that it's more clear about what it wants to be.
For whatever reason, it always takes EA like 2 or 3 years per platform or per generation to get Madden right.
Well, honestly, with Madden on the Wii, they were just trying to figure out what would sell. They didn't even really know. I mean, they think that everybody wants the hardcore 360 type of game, but throw that on the Wii and maybe it doesn't work.
And speaking of hardcore, I've been playing House of the Dead Overkill for Wii, which I rented.
Nice. Nice, Johnny.
Point and click shooting.
Yeah. Also known as the motherfucking game, because I think Chris Kohler ran a story about this on Game Life, but it does have the most instances of the word fuck that I've ever heard in a video game, by
short
far.
Of this podcast.
Oh, man. No, I mean, it blows away anything that we've
any
ever
done. Podcast,
it is,
yeah.
it's like every third word. It's absolutely ridiculous. To the point where you get completely used to it, you know, desensitized. It's not funny. It's not shocking. I mean, it doesn't help that the game's story is absolutely terrible. And I don't mean terrible in the B-movie grindhouse sense. I mean, it's just bad. It is not funny. I mean, it's obviously trying to be intentionally bad, but it fails in doing so in an entertaining way. And you just sit there watching it, just shaking your head. Like, why? Who thought this was a good idea? Like, I love the presentation. I love the visual effects of the grindhouse style. Like, you know, during the gameplay, even during the cutscenes, I think that stuff works really well. I think the 70s funky soundtrack is awesome.
Funker.
I love shooting zombies to, you know, that kind of stuff. It's great. But the story has to go. It's fucking awful. And not in a good way. Seriously, it's terrible. But beyond that, it's a fun game. I've had a friend in town, and he really loves shooting games, like arcade-style games. I was trying to get him to play it. I said, do you like House of the Dead? He said, well, I like it in the arcade. I probably won't like it on Wii. And I said, well, let's throw it in and try it. And after the first level, he was like, this is awesome. So he actually likes it more than I do, I think. For me, it's really too simple, because it is just shoot. You know, point and shoot. It's duck hunt shoot, with zombies.
Shooting gallery. Yeah,
it is a shooting gallery.
It hasn't
gallery.
Got the view, the changing your view like with the Umbrella Chronicles.
You play it with just the remote, and you can shift your view just barely if you point towards the edge of the screen. And, and usually what it'll do is it'll just shift over the view just very slightly so you can kind of get things that are just off screen. But that's usually not very useful. And, no, I mean, there's obviously no character movement. There's no view movement. There's really no strategy to the game. Occasionally you'll pick up a grenade, but it's not a big deal. Basically, you just go for headshots.
Awesome. Is it super easy to get headshots like it is in some shooting games on the Wii?
It is a lot easier than, Umbrella Chronicles. That game was really hard to get headshots. And
yeah, that was a common comment about that game, was that it was mysteriously difficult.
In House of the Dead, it is a lot easier. And it's really satisfying. When you get a headshot, the zombie basically explodes. And,
nice.
And, you know, it's extremely gory.
Well, you know, zombies have grenades in their heads.
Of course.
Yeah, basically.
Everybody knows that.
I mean, the game is really satisfying. I think the presentation during the gameplay as opposed to the story is really, really good. And I have to say that I really like the boss battles. Most of them are too easy. In fact, the whole game, at least in co-op mode, is really easy, I think. But the boss battles are all very interesting. They all play differently than the rest of the game. Visually, I mean, the character design on the bosses is really incredible. There's some pretty amazing, nasty-looking monsters that you fight for these bosses. And they do things with the visual effects, with the sound effects, with the camera motions, you know, with the enemy movement and, you know, sort of patterns and everything, that it makes it, you know, it's a boss battle. It feels very different from the rest of the game, and I really like those scenes. But the game is, you know, obviously very short, and we blew through it in a couple of days, actually really a couple hours total, you know. If you add it all together, really just a couple hours.
It's got
a couple
minutes.
It's got some sort of director's cut mode or something, isn't it? Where it's kind of like little bit extra bits kind of woven into the game.
Yeah, and it's pretty much like the director's cut of a movie usually is, in that you play it or you watch it and you think, what exactly was different there?
They took the narration out, like Blade Runner.
Yeah. No, I mean, it is... I mean, there's so many different director's cuts of Blade Runner, but...
final cut.
The final
cut. There will be another one, I promise.
The post-final cut. The ultimate cut.
Brett Favre retirement cut.
But yeah, I was looking forward to...
I heard it.
I was looking forward to playing the director's cut, because I thought, yeah, they'll add some new scenes, and, you know, maybe we'll take a different path around the mansion or the swamp or whatever. And we've played, like, three levels of the director's cut, and neither one of us can tell any difference, except that it's slightly harder... Mm. And they've added more of these golden brains, which are like bonus items that you shoot at if you get a chance. Okay. You know, they're just collectibles.
Golden brains.
You get extra points for them. But
I don't know why I did that, but it felt appropriate.
Yeah, no, it's stupid, but they're just collectibles, and they've added in a couple extras, but it's not impressive in terms of an extra feature.
Good as a rental, again.
Yeah. Absolutely a fun rental, absolutely. You know, I don't think it's a great game. I think it's good. It reminds me of my beef with, you know, these guided first-person experiences or whatever they want to call it, you know, the rail shooters. The issue is that they're very pattern-based, they're very twitchy, and, you know, a lot of times, a lot of these, including Overkill, are very combo-based. You know, the best way to rack up a big score and upgrade your guns and everything is to get a high combo, but the problem is it's really hard to hit zombies without missing because you don't have control over the camera. So you'll be shooting at zombies, you haven't even finished killing the zombie, and all of a sudden the camera shifts 180 degrees. You don't know that's about to happen. I mean, unless you've just memorized the level and exactly what happens, a lot of times you'll miss shots really through no fault of your own. So I have problems with that. And then the other thing is, I was telling my friend that I feel like these games should just be called tunnel vision simulators, because the whole thing is based on the premise that the characters you're playing as have absolutely no peripheral vision. They're shooting zombies here, and all of a sudden they turn 30 degrees, and there's tons of zombies over here that they couldn't see
before.
It's ridiculous, you know?
Where did you
it's
come
absolutely
from?
Ridiculous. Yeah. And then they look down, and oh my God, they're crawling at our feet. Really? You didn't see them coming?
Well,
I mean,
you realize that,
it's just fucking
that zombies
silly.
Are actually invisible until they get about 4 feet away,
well,
right?
Well, you would think so from playing this game. I mean,
have you ever seen a zombie more than 4 feet away from you?
You could call it nitpicking, but all I'm saying is
done.
The fact that you can't control your view or your movement, it only works because they're constantly just shoving zombies in the pieces of the screen that you can't see yet. I mean, if you could actually control your character, this game would be a joke. I mean, it really is lazy design, and I'm sorry to people who really enjoy playing through these games. I mean, I agree they're entertaining in a very mindless, shallow way for a very brief period of time, but the reason that these games aren't super, super popular and the reason that people complain about their simplicity is that they're really, really simple.
Yeah.
And they're predicated on these inherent limits in what they're putting in there, and it ends up being frustrating. You know, just like I said, I mean, you're trying to shoot this guy, so, or you're trying to shoot this this collectible item that's in the background. You get like a third of a second to shoot at it, and if you miss it, the camera's moved on and there's nothing you can do about it. And as a gamer, you know, the whole idea is that it's interactive, that you're in control of the experience in some way, and in these games, you're really not in control at all.
Well, the thing is, it's one of the few genres that is actually still really made for the arcades. I mean, you can see these things are completely made for the arcades. I mean, it's not like other genres where, you know, like platformers, they started off in the arcade, and over time, they kind of moved towards the home consoles, so, you know, they're longer and maybe not as difficult, whatever, but these things, that they are still just like something you would see at Dave and Buster's.
Yeah, it is. And I just feel like the whole genre is just very passive. And it's very passive, and there's really no decisions for the players to make.
Yeah.
And to me, that removes a lot of what I like about playing video games. Mm-hmm. And so they don't appeal to me that much. I mean, again, I can enjoy them in very brief spurts, but...
But, I mean, they're not aimed at you, though.
Well, obviously not. Do I think it's worth anyone's $50? No. Hell no. But it is a fun rental. I'm not trying to dissuade people from playing it, but I do think the game is a little overrated based on, you know, I heard a lot of good things about Overkill, and it's not anything special. Sorry. And I don't have much to say about Guitar Hero 5. I did get it this week. It is Guitar Hero. I mean, it's not dramatically different as far as I can tell, but I haven't been able to get very deep into it because I think there's some flaws in the disc printing, and it's catching up. It's freezing on load screens a lot. So I'm going to end up having to send it back to Activision and get it replaced. And
this sounds familiar.
Yeah, I know.
Does it do stereo?
It will not be the first time I've sent a Guitar Hero back to Activision. Yeah, exactly.
It's in bass channel only.
Well, this is the Xbox version, so I don't know if this is... I don't know if this is... I haven't even looked online to see if this is a pandemic or if, you know, maybe it's just me having this problem.
They're out to get you, Johnny. They actually keyed your disc.
A pandemic. It's like H1N1. Guitar
this
Hero?
Is going to Jonathan Metz. Get out the keys, gentlemen.
I'm patient.
Start put scratching. On the hazmat suits. Take out the disc for Johnny Metz. There you go. Send it off.
Did you get your free copy of Van Halen edition?
Well, it doesn't. See, Van Halen doesn't come out until December. So what happens?
You will get it.
There's a code in the manual for 5, and you basically just go to a website and put that in, and then they put your name down.
You know why it's to
Van
get
Halen.
A free copy of the unreleased Van Halen edition? Because nobody wants the fucking Van Halen.
Why? Because is it Van Hagar?
No, it's actually all David Lee Roth stuff.
Awesome.
Yeah, I'm not really a big fan of Van Halen. But I figure it's a free game, and there's probably five songs on there that I'll enjoy.
I was just hoping they had Right Now on there. That would be amazing.
The best part of the commercial, though, is how get a free copy of the unreleased Van. I'm like, did it just not get released because nobody wanted it?
Was it that
they're
bad?
Really displaying a lot of confidence in the product ahead of time.
Yeah, Van Halen just as a band didn't really age well, I don't think. You know, it's not like Metallica.
David Lee Roth sure as hell didn't age well.
No, have you seen that guy? Damn. Yes. Man, that guy has like less hair than I do. It's pathetic.
I'm the kind of guy who like usually defaults to classic rock stations just because it's like the most reliably entertaining radio station. And if Van Halen comes on, I usually change the station.
Well, it's because they're playing Panama or Jump. That's about it. I mean, there's nothing else. Hot for Teacher, maybe.
Oh God. Oh,
I think Eddie Van Halen's a good guitar player, but most of the songs that you hear from Van Halen these days, there's more synthesizer than there is guitar. It's true. Just really
well,
that's just
the product of the times, right, John? You remember the times?
Oh,
right?
I remember them well. Lived through them, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, this is a guy that's still got the Rocky IV soundtrack on his iPod.
What are you talking about? Rocky IV.
I'm shadowboxing while I'm listening to it. What are you talking about?
All the Rockies are classic films.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but only one of them has a synth-tastic soundtrack by the guy that did the soundtrack for Transformers the movie.
Mm-hmm. Each Rocky is perfection in and of itself.
Mm-hmm. Remember Rocky IV is mostly montages? That movie's like 80 minutes long, and I swear 50 of it is montages.
Yeah, I mean, like you have the Rocky training montage, usually in the mountains.
You've got the Rocky you've also got the clip show montage, where it just does bits from previous films, which I was quite
I know. I get to relive those classic films.
So it's kind of like the final episode of Seinfeld.
Yes, true.
More or less.
Except Rocky doesn't wind up in jail at the end, so.
John, he's ruined it.
Sorry. Sorry to anybody that wants to get the whole DVD set. My bad.
All right. We should move on. So, Greg, I did not even realize that Earthworm Jim 2 came out in Japan.
I don't know whether it even did come out originally, because there is I'm playing Earthworm Jim 2 on the Virtual Console that came out in Japan this past week, the Genesis version, and there's no Japanese text in it at all. Of any kind. So I don't know whether it's like an import game for them, maybe?
It doesn't seem like a character that Japanese people would really care about.
Especially like for the Genesis, because the Mega Drive in Japan was just not a success either, so...
Well, I mean, Earthworm Jim's story isn't so pivotal as to understand.
No, but just
the
like
game.
The stuff, like there's a section, for instance, in one of them is where you play a little quiz, like a game show, as part of the level, and there's text that asks you questions. And
well, and the other thing is, Earthworm Jim 2 would have been a pretty late Genesis.
Yeah,
game.
It would have been. It was indeed.
I think Mega Drive would be even less relevant at that point.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The PlayStation was out by then and stuff or something. But I mean, it's kind of weird that they're getting it first on Virtual Console. So if it is an import game, there isn't an import premium attached to it.
It is an import game, yes. So, well, wait. Oh, the Super NES version was released in Japan, but the Genesis one was not.
And this is the Genesis version, which makes it 600 points in Japan because they don't charge as much
because
it was never as popular. So I thought I'd pick it up. I did actually rent Earthworm Jim 2. Long ago. It was in the summer of 96. I was actually waiting for my N64 to show up, which was a very interminable wait.
Yeah.
So that's how I passed the time, was playing some Earthworm Jim 2 on the rental. And I'll never forget, the N64 finally got there and I unboxed it all. And I was ready to play Mario 64. I was absolutely ridiculously excited, and they hadn't shipped the step down converter, so
brutal.
I couldn't play it. It was brutal. That was the longest 2 days of my life waiting for that thing to show up. But before that, Earthworm Jim 2 was it did help pass the time. It was somewhat fun, but kind of played it now, what I'd forgotten is how much it's so far away from the sort of platformy run and gun formula of the first one. It's kind of like all gimmick levels. It's kind of straight, like the first level is very, very much like what you'd expect from the original, I guess. It's sort of fairly usual. There's some of that forced wackiness that you kind of expect with messing around with chair lifts and it's all this sort of stuff, but it's pretty much normal. But then after that, you've got the next level is just blasting through a giant wax maze which is plays very differently from the other game. Then the next level after that, you're supposedly like in an outfit of a salamander floating around in some intestines with holding the gun in your foot. And
nice.
Like this is where you do the quiz and you have to do a Simon Says routine and stuff. Again, it's completely different. And then the next level is a sort of mini game bouncing Peter puppies, little puppies. We'll figure that one out. up and down to safety. And then the next level after that is an isometric little shooter bit where you're on his rocket ship thing. It's, you know, none of it is like the core game.
It sounds very treasury.
You expected those kinds of levels to kind of punctuate normal ones, but it's just a big string of them. Yeah, the first one had the submarine bit. It had Bond. Did anyone play the first one here?
Yes.
No.
A long time ago.
Yeah, the submarine bit, which was really hard. And then
I never
beat
that part.
The bungee jump boss fight with the guy made out of snot and stuff. You know, like you had things that were not the normal kind of action, but it was mixed in. Whereas this is all like that, so it's kind of surprising, I guess. They wanted to be somewhat different because it was pretty hot on the heels of the first one was a late era title, wasn't it? Like 94 or something. So I guess they just, you know, got it out pretty quick and did something different. But it's not unentertaining. It's quite fun. The whole style of it, it just feel very mid-90s, you know, the phoned in kind of silliness and stuff. Like using big fat pigs to do things and, you know, all this kind of stupid stuff. It's very lively. I mean, it does look amazingly good for a Genesis game. And when you take it back to Altered Beast at the beginning or whatever, it's kind of amazing to get to that point at the end.
Power up.
The animation is so fluid. I mean, it's kind of over animated, really, but it does look very nice. And it's impressive how they mask how limited the Genesis color palette is. Because, I mean, to put it in perspective, I mean, the Genesis color palette is not only vastly much more limited than the Super Nintendo one, but it's actually poorer than the TurboGrafx.
Wow. I didn't know that.
It was not good.
Yeah. There are a few games that I know of that really do a great job hiding that.
Well, I think Gunstar Heroes is one of them because it's just very bright. So, you know, there's not a lot of, you know, subtle shades to the colors.
Right.
But it's bold, colorful. And it's simple, it's bright, so it kind of covers that up.
And Dynamite Heady was too.
Yeah. I mean, Treasure knew what they were doing with the Genesis, no doubt.
Yeah, it was their specialty, really.
And so this, from a technical point of view, is quite impressive. It is fun, despite its sort of gimmickry. Although, I did actually see an episode of the cartoon not so long ago, and I was surprised by how actually that was not terrible.
Yeah,
and
I forgot
There was a bunch of jokes in it that would have gone way over my head when I was a kid, like jokes about Rush Limbaugh, references to Dune.
There were a few
I don't know how many people watching those shows got those jokes.
There were like three or four cartoons that came out around that time that really had these references that, as when I was younger, I didn't get, but when I got old, it's like, what the hell?
Yeah.
So, John, also been digging through Virtual Console.
Yeah, you know, I'm on my money-saving kick, so I decided to pick up Phantasy Star. As you know, I'm kind of a Sega Master System buff, kind of from back in the day. That was my first choice as opposed to the NES.
I thought you were a Commodore guy.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm definitely a Commodore guy. But in terms of consoles, I've always been like kind of like a hardware freak. And so the Sega Master System hardware was more impressive than the NES hardware. So that was my console of choice back in the day. Obviously a very bad choice. I compounded that by following it up with the TurboGrafx 16.
I think the TurboGrafx is still a lot more good games on it.
Tell me you did not buy a Wii, because if you did, we're in trouble. We're all done for.
But yeah, I picked up Phantasy Star, and actually I'm quite impressed by it. I played it just very briefly, but I mean, you can tell a lot about an RPG from just the first few, you know, levels of it. And bear in mind, it came out in 1988, so it's quite old. I mean, it's really getting up there. It was like a contemporary RPG with like Final Fantasy, the original one.
And I guess it was around the same time that Dragon Quest came out in America, although it was a couple years old in Japan at the time.
Yeah. I mean, the interesting thing with this game is that I remember it being really, really expensive, so I actually never bought it. I never owned it for the Sega Master System. Because this was when everybody was, and this kind of spilled over into the 16-bit era, where everything was about megabits, and this game has X amount of megabits, and so therefore it's better than your game. And
16 megabit cartridge.
Yeah, and so this was...
And then you realize 16 megabit is nothing.
Yeah, and so the big thing of this one is that it was a 4 megabit cartridge where...
Holy shit!
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I read up on
the
it.
The sad thing is I can remember the numbers, like Donkey Kong was 32 megabits and yep. Super Metroid is 24. It's so sad.
Yep. I think a typical Master System game was, I think, 128K, and this one was like 512, so that was amazing at the time, right? But I remember it costing a lot of money, so I was not able to buy it, but it was like kind of like one of the marquee titles, so I figured I'd check it out. And the thing that really stood out to me is that, okay, first off, it has a female protagonist, which is very interesting for 1988, yeah. That's very interesting. And also, it doesn't have the same kind of usability flaws that Final Fantasy has.
Oh, and particularly the first Dragon Quest.
Yeah, the first Dragon Quest. I remember, I thought about you, Johnny, because I remember you talking about how the first Dragon Quest had the whole thing where I think it was with the stairs.
You have a command for stairs. called stairs.
Stairs.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah. Done.
Yeah, I mean, just completely like dumb stuff like that. And it's really not there in Phantasy Star. In Phantasy Star, the only thing like that I've kind of seen is at the end of a battle, you're presented with a treasure chest, and it asks you whether or not you want to open it. Now, it seems kind of pointless, but I think probably later on, you know, there's probably like things pop out of the chest and attack
H1N1 pops out.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, so it's not. And say the same thing with Final Fantasy II. One of my pet peeves with that game was that if you selected enemies during a battle and you selected an enemy that died before you got to it, you just wouldn't attack. It was the kind of stuff where you're like, come on, who really designed this? This is just silly. And Phantasy Star doesn't really have anything like that. It's actually really well done. It kind of has, it retains like a lot of elements that were in kind of those early Ultima games. It's very much like, I think for a console, it was probably ahead of its time. But in terms of like games that were out on PC at the time, like Ultima, Wizardry, like Questron, those kind of games. I mean, one of the things that people talk about is the 3D area, pseudo 3D areas where you're kind of presented with this.
The dungeons.
Yeah, exactly. And like those were already in Wizardry and all those kind of games like that. But in consoles, they were really new. So Phantasy Star really brought those in.
I play this on the GBA as part of the Phantasy Star collection.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I got pretty far in the first one before I kind of got stuck, or it just started to get really difficult after a while. And
it's very grindy.
It is really grindy, yeah. But I was just eager to try two.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I kind of like the first person dungeon design, but it is really disorienting.
Well, they don't have a map.
Right. There's no auto map. It would be hard to even make your own map. You'd have to be really meticulous.
Yep.
Whereas, you know, Phantasy Star 2, it just has, you know, more Dragon Quest style dungeons. It's just overhead. It looks like everything else. And it's a little disappointing that it lost that uniqueness, but at the same time, it's just so much easier to work with. You know, it's just so much easier to figure out what's going on.
Yeah, I mean, it could really, really benefit from an auto map because you're just kind of going through. You have no idea. Like, it's pretty much up to you to map stuff out. But, you know, it's good. I'm looking forward to going through it.
I mean, it seems like a really good companion to some more modern games, but newer games that are really heavily based on that kind of stuff, like Etrian Odyssey and I think Darkspire.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these are like DS games that are very similar to Phantasy Star, I think.
Yeah, I actually thought about Darkspire. It's interesting you should mention that because they kind of, you know, kind of the selling point of that game is, oh, well, it's a throwback game.
Okay, that's the end of New Business. We're going to take a break, and we'll be back with our most anticipated games of fall 2009. Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
This week, we have extensive coverage of a number of forthcoming releases, starting with previews of the highly anticipated Mario & Luigi Bowser's Inside Story and DJ Hero. Next, there's our hands-on impressions of Skycrawlers, The Innocent Aces by Aaron Kaluska, who describes its aerial motion controls as unconventional but with a wonderful feel.
Also, be sure to check out our Mini Ninjas interview with IO Interactive, and for something completely different, check out our chat with Norwegian electro rockers Data Rock.
Keep checking for more great reviews, news, and opinion at NintendoWorldReport.com. Welcome back, everyone, and it's time for our fall preview 2009. I think we did this about a year ago for last season and last holiday season, and it's time to do it again. Of course, these are all going to be our most anticipated Wii and DS games. I guess there we could maybe have a separate discussion about what we're interested in for other platforms, but these will be for Wii and DS, and I also wanted to kind of limit it to retail, just because I feel like things like Cave Story and Night Game and the new Bomberman, all that stuff, it feels kind of like a separate discussion as well. These are going to be retail games. So what I did was I just kind of collected a list from all four of us as to the games that we're most looking forward to, and I figured we'll kind of go through them and talk about why we're excited about these. In some cases, they may be games that you don't know a whole lot about, or maybe we don't know much about, and we're just curious, and we're just kind of eager to see how they turn out. But starting with games that are coming out very soon, actually, we have Scribblenauts, and I think, John, you were the one who mentioned this, so give us a little spiel on this, on Scribblenauts for DS.
Well, that's the thing. It's funny because, you know, I'm looking forward to this game, but, you know, I haven't played it. You know, there's other people that have played at E3, but it just seems really cool. I mean, the idea is, from what I understand, is solving puzzles by drawing things that you think up.
Well, you don't draw them, you write them.
And so, but there's a large kind of, like, I guess you could say dictionary or vocabulary of things that you can make appear. So yeah, I mean, it just looks really, really crazy, and I mean, it's gotten really good buzz. So I'm looking forward to it. I think that it'll be one of the more interesting uses of the DS, definitely coming up.
Yeah, and yet it's a game that, I mean, really could be done on any system. I think I've said this not too long ago, but like it seems well suited for the DS in terms of the nature of it. Like, it should be a good portable game. It should be something. It's a puzzle game, so, you know, it should be something you can go in and solve a few puzzles and then put it down for a while if you want to. But I would be surprised if this stays a DS exclusive, just because of the hype that it's getting and because it seems pretty easy to transfer the concept over to other platforms.
Yeah.
But I'm really excited for it too, and it comes out here in just a couple weeks. And I think my concern about it at this point is over the quality of the puzzle designs themselves. Like, I think the core mechanic of basically you write in anything you want and it appears, like, that's pretty much been demonstrated that it works and it's amazing and it gets people excited. But then to me, the next step is, for it to really be a successful game, the next step is, what do you do with that?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, they have to be including a lot of levels and really high quality levels that make you come up with ideas that'll be fun. You know, they have to be things that keep it varied and keep you on your toes and make you think in different ways. And mm-hmm. if they can do that, it'll be pretty incredible.
Yeah,
I think.
I mean, the more difficult advanced ones that you'd have in the game, I mean, they've got to walk a pretty fine line between being, you know, not obvious, between being clever, but not being simply obtuse or obscure.
Yeah.
Because obviously it starts off and it's going to be just like screwing around, and you could probably do everything a bunch of different ways, and it's all kind of fun. But I guess if it's going to get more challenging, it has to get a little more tightly defined. But if it gets too far down that road, it's going to lose the charm of like what the game is about in the earlier stages.
I feel like if a game is too open-ended, it stops feeling like a game to me, and it's just more of a pure sandbox kind of a thing. It's more of a toy. And in Scribblenauts, you know, the promise is there for it to be like a really cool puzzle game where they actually design awesome puzzles. And there's an editor as well for you to make your own. But, you know, like, I really want to see that they have packed in a couple hundred awesome puzzles that I can not only solve any way I want to, but that I have to really think about and that I want to solve in more than one way and that I want to solve with unique items that I haven't used before.
Yeah, well, they have to make sense, right? They can't just be random.
Right.
Right.
Exactly.
Well, I think some of puzzles they've shown are more or less, here's a world, you can play with it. And then some of the ones they've shown, it's really up to how creative you are. Like, I don't think they designed it with any solution in mind. It's just like, well, screw around till you figure out something that works.
Yeah, well, that's certainly how I'd expect it to start. But, I mean, some of what I've heard about the game is that, you know, it does get a bit more intricate as it goes. And I hope so. I hope it goes.
That sounds good.
If it can make that transition from being a sort of fun toy to actually being a sort of challenging, evolving game in a more classic sense, then I think that it will probably score very, very highly and people will enjoy it a great deal.
Well, another game coming out really soon is Mario & Luigi Bowser's Inside Story. And I don't know, maybe all of us are excited about this game. But Greg brought it up first, and so I wanted to ask Greg. I mean, you've probably played the first two, right?
Yeah, I did.
This is the third game in the series. And what makes you excited about this one, and how do you think it's going to be different?
I mean, for a start, I really enjoyed the first two. I mean, there's some things about, you know, Part Lizard Toy that weren't great, you know, but I still enjoyed it a great deal. The fact is, I mean, it kind of sneaks up on you, but you know, that was nearly 4 years ago.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. That came out. I played it at launch at the end of 2005. I mean, it's kind of shocking that it has been that long. So whereas that was a bit hot on the heels of the original Mario and Luigi, this is very much longer after, and I'm really ready to play the game again. I played it at the Nintendo E3 event in London. It looks fantastic. I'm very enthused by the dual kind of gameplay facets of playing as Mario and Luigi inside Bowser and then playing as Bowser outside, in terms of injecting a bit of variety into the gameplay that you might not have had quite so much in Partners in Time, which kind of got a bit convoluted and things. So it's it's going to deliver in terms of the charm, in terms of the script and the quality of the localization and all that sort of thing. And then in terms of the game, you know, for what we've seen, it looks good. It got a very good reception in Japan. It sold very well in Japan as well. So all the signs are good for this game.
It was one of my favorite demos at E3, I have to say. And it's a little hard for me to even say exactly why I liked it so much. It was just super charming and just fun and beautiful. And I don't know. I think, you know, if they put exactly that demo on the Nintendo channel and let people download it, you know, everybody who plays that will be interested in picking it up. That's what I think. So hopefully they'll do that. That was a fantastic demo. Now, moving on to a completely different kind of game, but Skycrawlers. James, I still don't know that much about Skycrawlers, so tell me about what they're doing with it for the American release.
The situation with the game is it's a licensed game, but it's not a licensed game in the same context that we usually view licensed games here, which is they're somewhat developed in a vacuum from the actual main franchise, where you'll wind up with two games that, yeah, it's the same story, but there's not a lot of shared material, if that makes sense. As I understand it, this game is sort of a counterpoint to an anime movie that came out around the same time.
Last year.
It's set in like the same world, the same time, but it's a different story set in that world. So it's basically an Ace Combat game on the Wii set in a world that was originally designed as part of a manga series. The movie did get a U.S. release recently, if I recall, or it's getting one soon. So I imagine their goal for the game is they're just going to localize it directly as best they can and just sort of release it on basically on the fact that it is an Ace Combat game.
I mean, do you think XE can really push it as an Ace Combat game, given that they're not Namco?
You know, I think that the subtitle is kind of a conceit to that.
Yeah, it's their way of sneaking it in there, the innocent aces, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty subtle, though.
That's a very, very niche franchise already, the Ace Combat series. There's not a huge number of casual Ace Combat fans. It's a relatively ravenous fan base, so they're gonna.
I assume this is not based on some sort of high volume strategy.
No, and nothing XE does is based on that strategy.
Exactly, it's always very niche and very targeted.
So I mean, the people who like the Ace Combat series are gonna know who Project Aces is.
Okay,
I believe they will.
Have you heard anything about whether the American version's gonna have a different control scheme?
I heard bad things about the control when it initially came out, but since then I've heard somewhat positive things about the control.
So. Yeah, see, I think it's just one of those things, again, where it's a matter of taste. In some cases, you know, some people warm to the motion control, some don't. But it has got the GameCube option in there.
Yeah.
So, or it certainly did in Japan. I see no reason why they would take that out. So you've got that kind of baseline. To, you know, if you do like Ace Combat style games, you'd pretty much be able to play it like an Ace Combat game. If you don't take to the new controls.
I mean, this was a pretty involved game's development, I suppose, because there are fully animated cutscenes between each mission, which is out of the ordinary for a Project Aces title. That's cool. Telling the story.
I mean, it goes with the movie, though, I guess.
Yeah, and they're actually produced by a fairly renowned production studio in Japan.
Well, it's been a long time since I played a flying game, like an aerial combat game, but maybe Skycrawlers will be the one to do it.
It's been about 2 weeks for me, so it's...
I'll wait to hear what you think.
All right.
I think that's November. I think that's coming in.
Now, going more mainstream here, John mentioned DJ Hero in his submissions for
this
list.
I'm not sure that's mainstream unless you enjoy wearing rainbow-colored glasses. And
we'll see. John, are you wearing your butterfly wings right now?
Of course, man. I have my glow sticks and everything. But no, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, it's mostly mashups between typically like kind of like classic or 80s rock songs and kind of like hip hop songs of today. So it's not really like ravey, if that's what you're saying.
It's all like the Run DMC version of Walk This Way.
Well, yeah, I mean, like they're mixing stuff like Bowie Let's Dance with like No Doubt.
Oh God, no!
You know, like
that's a bad example, but I think there are a lot of really cool sounding.
John,
mashups.
If that is in the game, you are legally obligated to give the game a 1 out of 10. I mean, that's just terrible. That is a crime.
But like beyond the music selection, John, I mean, what do you think about the controller and the style of play? Because I'm hearing that it's a lot like rubbing your belly and patting your head, or just
John's doing
sounds
that right
like a
now.
Lot to wrap your head around unless you actually know how to DJ.
Well, nah, I mean, I don't think so. I mean, the thing is, I'm curious to really see how they kind of execute it in a way that's meaningful.
In a way that's accessible? Because Guitar Hero is always really accessible.
Yeah, exactly. So it's more accessible than a lot of video games in a way.
Yeah.
Because it has this kind of more mainstream kind of attraction, whereas I'm not so sure about this one.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is with DJ Hero is that I'm looking forward to it, but at the same time, I'm kind of waiting for it to be sort of a disaster.
You thinking this is going to be where Activision's luck runs out with selling ridiculously expensive
games?
Well,
it is $120,
yeah,
and that's the cheapest version.
I'm looking at it like it could possibly not be very cohesive, you know? Yeah, it uses a lot of mashups, but it almost seems like the entire game concept is kind of a mashup. Like, how different is it going to be from Guitar Hero?
I think it's just going to be a lot harder. It seems to me with DJ Hero, and especially the way it's been promoted so far, is that it seems like Activision expects a more limited, like more hardcore, more really devoted, knowledgeable fan base for this game.
Yeah,
and so they've made the game more technical, more difficult, less accessible. They're not really trying to make it real mainstream.
Well, you couldn't. I mean,
it sounds like they're just catering to people who are already into remix culture DJ culture.
But see, I mean, who hasn't at one point been like, oh yeah, I could play guitar, that'd be awesome.
Right.
Like I guarantee you 90% of the people in the world have never thought, I want to be a DJ and do mashups.
Right.
Yeah.
It's a pretty very specific interest. It just makes me wonder, have they found the limit of extending the Guitar Hero aura, you know, like have they gone too far? Basically, I'm not saying won't be a fun game, but I just wonder, like, have they gotten to the point where people will no longer care, or not enough people will care?
I guess the other thing for something new in the market this holiday season that's $120 or whatever is that with the hardware prices coming down, it just looks worse value. Yeah, all the time.
Yeah,
in terms of psychologically, you know, you could buy a PS3 or a 360 Elite for $300, and it's nearly half that price for DJ Hero. It's just, I think,
it's too much.
More mainstream consumers' minds, it looks very, very expensive. So it might be more limited to the more enthusiast crowd, I think.
Well, a game that will have plenty of mainstream appeal is one that I kind of put in for this feature, and that's New Super Mario Bros. Wii. And
never heard of it.
We've talked about it a lot. It's funny, you know, Nintendo still hasn't given us a firm release date on it, but they've been very firm that it's going to come out this year.
Yeah, there's some retailer rumblings about November on this one, which makes sense. Yeah,
that's exactly what I would expect. The weekend before Black Friday or whatever.
Yeah.
Or the Monday before Black Friday. It's very, very good bet that that'll be the day.
Because we know Wii Fit's coming in a fair bit before that, to the extent that they are kind of in any sense rivalry anyway, but, you know, there'd be some distance between the two.
Yeah. And you know, New Super Mario Bros. Wii is, I don't think it's going to be a mind-blowing experience. I don't think it's a super top shelf kind of a project from Nintendo or Shigeru Miyamoto or anything like that. But I do, I will say it's probably the most fun that I had at E3 playing that game. And I, that's exactly what I expect from it. It's a game that on some level I can't get really super excited about it because I don't think it's going to show me anything super new or really exciting or cutting edge or anything like that. But I do think it will be probably the best $50 I spend this year. In terms of the amount of entertainment I'm going to get out of it, the number of different ways you can play it, and just the replayability of it. It just seems like the kind of thing that it's almost like Smash Brothers, you know. I mean, the level design is one thing, but like just playing the game with four people is fun,
mm-hmm.
almost regardless of whether you're making progress through the levels or not. It's just
I could see that.
They've built in the levels of interaction that they've built into are entertaining in and of themselves, so it just seems like the game develops itself almost once you get the multiplayer working. I guess the big question in my mind is whether it'll be fun and interesting to play through by yourself, because this is the kind of game that I can probably get other people to come play without too much trouble. But at the same time, you know, I have a one bedroom apartment. I live alone. I usually play games by myself, and I would like to be able to play this by myself and it be
get
fun.
Sort of value out of it, you know?
Yeah. I just want to have it both ways.
I mean, that's going to come down to the elegance of the level design to a large extent, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So, difficult to assess with what we've seen of it so far, but it certainly can be done. I guess it depends on how much effort they put into that end of it, which is kind of unclear because it doesn't necessarily seem like, you know, on the face of it, it doesn't seem like there's the most effort gone into it. As I kind of said when I had played it previously, you know, the fact that the world themes are apparently precisely the same as the DS game doesn't seem to suggest that there's been the most investment, but you know, that was what they were willing to show at that time, so we don't really know.
Well, the fact that they're throwing in things like the new costumes.
Yeah, the costumes are, you know, because you've got like the propeller suit and the penguin suit is very fun.
Yeah, those are exciting, and they seem well done. They seem to have more depth and complexity and more possibilities than something like the supersized Mario from the DS game.
Yeah, or the blue shell thing, which was bizarre.
Not a fan of the blue shell either, except in the multiplayer, actually. But and then, you know, things like adding Yoshi. That is actually one of the most exciting things about it.
He's fun for messing with people because you can just eat people, basically.
That's one of the coolest features for me. But moving on, James, believe you brought up the Crystal Bearers.
Yes.
It's kind of mind-blowing to think that we're going to have a new Final Fantasy for Wii.
Yeah.
This Christmas. And, it's still such a big question mark. I mean, what do you think about it?
Well, I understand it better now, having read the Nintendo Power article that came out the last issue. I'm still kind of unclear on how the game plays, even though I've played it, which is a very weird feeling to have. That I've played this game in two times now, 25 minutes each.
So, I mean, is it like a big kind of, you know, different sections are going to play almost like different genres kind of thing? I mean, is that
a little bit,
at?
Yeah. I mean, that's what it feels like.
So you're saying that this is Final Fantasy Day of Crisis? Is that
No, it's not nearly that different. Like, I feel like there's maybe two or three different gameplay styles that I've seen, and they're all interlevied. It's just they're different. So There was two different types of on-rail gameplay that I've seen so far. And then there's kind of just a world exploration gameplay where I can manipulate stuff.
So the on-rail stuff, is that like Dragon Quest Swords?
No. It's more like an on-rail shooter. So
I'd say it's more like Dead Space Extraction.
A little bit.
You know, you have this kinesis power and sort of shooting shit.
So it happened twice in the demo. And the first one is you've jumped off the top of an airplane because you're some kind of crazy-ass bastard. And you're shooting these monsters that are flying all around you. And you basically have this giant-ass cannon that you're using to shoot them. And then later in the game, in the demo, towards the end, you're riding on the back of a chocobo, and you're interacting with the environment to basically push your pursuers away, who are chasing from behind you. So the closest thing I can equate it to is the milk cart game in Majora's Mask.
Oh yeah, I remember.
But maybe a little bit more to it than that, I think. And then in the world exploration, I was walking around a town, and your character has the ability to pick stuff up with his power, which is what makes him a crystal bearer, and heave things around. So I guess there's some puzzle solving you can do with that. There was a little bit of that in the demo.
Do you think it's going to come out feeling like a Final Fantasy game, or is it going to feel like some weird-ass spin-off thing that never really comes together?
Well, the other thing is, like, how much is it even going to feel like a Crystal Chronicles game?
Yeah.
Well, it is a Crystal Chronicles game, because having read what I've read now, the preview focuses very heavily on the story and the design of the game versus the gameplay of the game. So there is a fairly detailed story. It is clearly set in the Crystal Chronicles world, although apparently sometime considerably later, which is funny because this is the third game in the Crystal Chronicles series that is set, quote, sometime considerably later. But, you know, there, a lot of the cues of the world are there. There's, you know, the races that you've come to expect. Magic, it takes the form very similar to how it takes in the original Crystal Chronicles game. And there does appear to be a very strong storytelling element in this game based on the preview I read, which is what made me more excited about it, because I'm thinking, well, they actually are devoting efforts to create a coherent story that was what you'd expect from a Final Fantasy title.
Well, that's exciting.
I mean, it's Nintendo power, so take it with what you will, but they do seem very, very excited about the game.
It's just interesting to see what's going to come out of it from the point of view that, you know, to perhaps draw another unhappy comparison to Disaster, you know, it's been a long time coming. And sometimes you do wonder what comes out at the end of those sorts of processes.
They actually do discuss that in the article of what the hell's been going on with this game. You know, it's been in development for so long. And they basically say, not explicitly, because the developer, although he's interviewed, doesn't say it, the game was rebooted more than once. Completely.
Not surprised.
I mean, sometimes, you know, things could turn out very well after a long development cycle, but when it's kind of...
Sure.
If you're kind of starting from scratch like that, you don't necessarily get any of the benefits of a long development cycle because you don't get the refinements.
The closest thing we have is regarding that particular element is there's a question during an interview they give, and Nintendo Power writer asks, at one point during development, after no one had seen the game for a while, many media outlets claimed the game was canceled. How'd that make you feel about that? And his answer is very odd. He says, right about that time I had locked myself in the development studio thinking, quote, fans are waiting. We must show this game in a playable form as soon as possible. So when I first heard the rumor, I was very surprised. But showing a playable demo at E3, I think we were able to prove that rumor false. He thinks he was able to prove a rumor false that the game was canceled by letting people play it.
A few years late, mind you.
A few years late. Yeah.
All right. Greg,
mm-hmm.
Silent Hill Shattered Memories. This is another one that's coming out pretty soon, I guess. Maybe September, October.
I think the last I heard was November for this. I think it might have just got pushed a little, actually.
Maybe November 3rd, something like that. Okay.
Yeah, a bit later, but I mean, I guess what interests me about this, you've heard good things, you know, some of the people that played it for us at E3, like Francesca and Zach, I think, both seemed to like it. And
I was a little less sold on it than they were, I agree. I liked certain aspects of it a lot.
It looks very, very nice when you see it.
It does.
I guess that's the first thing that strikes it when you're someone like me who hasn't had the opportunity to play it. But what really interests me about it, I've never played a Silent Hill game before. It's more the kind of, you know, horror game I would like to play. It's a bit more psychological and, you know, less the, you know, zombie dog jumping through the window, but what I like about this, first of all, is it's kind of stripping out the combat, and it's, you know, there's no combat in the game, and the controls are a bit different a lot. So some of those, you know, very the traditional survival horror things that I just did not like about the old Resident Evil games, which would have also applied to the old Silent Hill games, are gone. So that's the first sort of barrier to entry gone.
Yeah.
And then you've got these sort of interesting aspects, like the psychological quiz at the start that's going to kind of configure some of what's going to happen to your character as it tells a story. And they're going to use the Wii Remote in some ways, like with the speaker, with the static that's always been in the games and things like that. So it just sounds like they've had, you know, a lot of pretty sensible ideas about how to do it on Wii, how to update it, how to kind of retell the original story in a different way, so it will feel good for people who are Silent Hill fans, but at the same time, it's a kind of natural introduction for someone like me who isn't.
All right. I did want to mention at least one more game here, and I think A Boy and His Blob is one that I'm really curious about, and we've talked about it fairly recently. We had Neil on after he got to play it, so you can go listen to that. And I don't have much else to say about it except that I just think this is one of those game announcements that you're like, wow, really? Like, they're making a new Boy and His Blob game? And then they show it, and it looks like such a brilliant take on a classic game that is really not very relevant anymore.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the original games are, they're so old at this point. That franchise, here's what I like about it, I guess. They're not really trading on the name, because the name doesn't really sell that game at all.
Sure, yeah.
Like, nobody even knows what that is anymore. If you're under 20 years old, you've never even played
it. This isn't Punch-Out, you know? I mean, that's
no,
the difference.
No, it's not Punch-Out at all.
Because Punch-Out is something that hadn't really necessarily been kept current, but the name would sell it.
Right. And in the case of Punch-Out, they obviously took a very conservative approach where they said, you know, the original was so good, let's just kind of recreate that with modern technology and it'll still be fun. And that worked for them. Whereas what I like with A Boy and His Blob is they went back and said, you know, this is not a very, it's not exactly a famous game. It's not exactly a beloved game or a popular game. But what it was an interesting game. It was an innovative, ambitious game, maybe too ambitious for the technology that they had back then. Mm-hmm. And so what we want to do is we want to take some of these ideas and reapproach them and refine them, you know, kind of take the basic design that they used to have, but let's make the Boy and His Blob game that David Crane would have made if he could back in the mid 80s or the late 80s. And, you know, let's completely reimagine this. It's almost a Battlestar Galactica kind of situation where they're like, you know, this thing was kind of shitty back in the day, but, you know, like, but we think it had some cool ideas. So let's use what was good, replace everything else, and make something awesome. And there it is. And, you know, the fact that it's a 2D hand-drawn game in 2009, absolutely gorgeous. The fact that it is this action platformer puzzle game is not a very typical kind of a game at all. I mean, it's really actually cool that anybody's making a game like this at all. I just think it has so much potential.
I'm really looking forward to this one.
I'm a little concerned in that I haven't been really impressed with WayForward's previous work.
What, not even Contra? Like Contra 4?
Contra 4 is good for what it is, just not my thing. Mm-hmm. You know, no, it's just not for me.
There was someone who loves Contra. I think they did a good job with it. You know, and they did just go ultra conservative with it. You know, they put their own spin on it in places, and I think did a pretty good job. So I think that it's certainly within their repertoire to do this well, although I think this is probably somewhat more demanding.
Well, it is their first Wii game other than Lit. And, you know, Lit was lacking in execution, perhaps.
Hmm.
But from what everybody says, I haven't played it myself. But, you know, this is completely different than Lit, of course. Very, very different kind of a project. So it's, you know, it's paving new ground for them. And it's just exciting, I think. If you're not convinced, if you're not interested in A Boy and His Blob, do yourself a favor and go look up a video. And or even screenshots, but especially a video of it, and I think your eyes will light up a little bit when you see that. And for me, that's why I'm really curious to see that, and I really want to get my hands on it because I haven't been able to do so yet.
I've got an honorary mention here. Because James Charlton, just before we started recording, dug up, looks like Nintendo of Japan have scheduled Sin of Punishment 2 for this year in Japan.
Yep. Oh,
so
nice.
I'll be playing it immediately.
Can't wait to hear what you say about it.
That just made 2009 a whole lot better for me.
I don't even think we need to wait to hear what Greg is going to say about this game. I think we can pretty much already infer what's going to be said.
Greg has demanding tastes,
I don't know.
You know?
It has lots to live up to.
Yeah, exactly. From my point of view, it has a great deal to live up to. I mean, obviously, I could already sort of attest for what I have played of it, that the controls seem to be all as you would hope they would be. But, you know, you've got to design the game to take advantage of them, and we'll see with that.
And will it have enough of Saki?
Yeah, let's just say I ain't gonna be crying in my soup about not understanding what's going on with the Japanese.
I don't think you'd understand what's going on with
exactly.
A native language.
No, it's less, not exactly a story, more of an acid trip, really.
Yeah.
So we really need to finish up this feature segment, but I did want to mention a couple other games that came up that we didn't quite have time to talk about. Legend of Zelda Spirit Tracks. Not exactly sure what more we can say about that right now, but it's going to be a big release, of course, and that is coming out.
Yeah, I was somewhat encouraged by the whole, you know, you and your phantom companion kind of gameplay. They could do some clever things with that.
I feel like that game got way too harshly criticized.
Well, the train bit was poor as a demo.
Well,
and that is the big key feature. That's the stuff, the thing that's going to be on the box is the train. And
yeah, but for me, what was more important was what was going on in the dungeons. And considering that was probably a very early dungeon, and all that, I was somewhat encouraged by that.
Yeah, of course, Dead Space Extraction. Greg brought this up.
Yeah.
Again, I'm not a big fan of the rail shooter thing, and
yeah, I guess the main thing why I kind of brought this up rather than say Darkside Chronicles was just that it seems like it might be a little more than that. I'm not expecting
it to
be
a little more than that.
I'm not expecting it to be way more than, you know, the sort of carnival ride of something like House of the Dead, but you've got these like different kinds of weapons that are more substantively different. They have secondary functions. They, you know, in some cases they're more like tools. You've got the kinesis powers, and you know, it could be. It seems like it could be more involved and not just a gallery. And you know, apparently the graphics are very good, and you know, the atmosphere is kind of all there. And so I think of all those, you know, there's been quite a number of them now, and there's going to be more. And
yes,
a lot of people seem to think there's something to commend about them, but this is the one that I find the most interesting.
It is one of the most sophisticated rail shooters that you'll see. I was actually looking forward to playing it, and the demo let me down a bit, but you know, you can't always go by that, so.
Yeah, and it's heavy on the atmosphere, isn't it? So.
Oh yeah, it was a bad environment to play.
Well, and I think the demo didn't do anything for the first like 10 minutes. I mean, really.
Yeah, there was as James famously pointed out, there was way too much cutscene and not enough playing in that demo. A lot of E3 demos make that mistake.
Meanwhile, you've got like people running around screaming in the EA booth. It wasn't good.
Yeah. So another game that came up, Nostalgia, the DS RPG. Mm-hmm. It looks a lot like Skies of Arcadia, and it's made by, or at least partially made by, I think, by Matrix, who are the people behind Final Fantasy IV Remake.
It's also made by the people who made Lord of Thunder and Gate of Thunder. Red
Seriously?
Entertainment. Yeah, Red
Lords
Entertainment, man.
Of Thunder.
Wow.
They also made Fossil Fighters, if you want to make it even stranger. There is some weird shit coming out of Red Entertainment.
Well, I'm glad
that's
still
crazy.
Doing something.
That is crazy.
I was actually found it out because I was looking up what Red Entertainment did so I could note it in my review of Fossil Fighters.
Lords.
And right there, Lords of Thunder, Gate of Thunder. I was like, oh my god.
Yeah. I think you should have to recuse yourself from that review.
Well, unfortunately, I can put in there they're the developers of that game, but it's completely irrelevant. I mean, like, I want to reference
it's
it.
Only 15 years ago in a completely different genre.
All right. Well, we're going to have to wrap up the feature now, so we'll take a break and be back with your listener mail. Back to wrap up the show with listener mail, and James has the first letter.
So, Mario is French from Toronto writes, have any of you ever come across a game or a type of game you couldn't finish, not because of game design, but because you just physically can't play it anymore? I was playing Metroid Prime Corruption last week, and I started feeling really sick to the point where I had to stop playing, throw up in the washroom, and take a power nap just so I would feel good enough to continue playing. Unfortunately, I started feeling sick again, at which point I traded the game in for another game that also made me feel physically sick, Metal Gear Solid 4. Don't get me wrong, I thought Corruption was a pretty interesting game. I really liked it, but I just couldn't continue.
Well, it's been a while since I've heard about anybody getting motion sick from a game. It seemed more common back in the era of Doom, you know, when 3D graphics were so new and people had never seen them before.
Well, the effect is still valid. Your brain's anticipating motion, but your body's not feeling it.
Mm-hmm. It is, but motion sickness is something that you can train out of, basically. I mean, some people are innately more affected by it
than others. NASA Johnny's breaking us all
the
stats.
Yeah, sorry. I've actually taken a class on this shit. So, and space motion sickness is really very similar to any other kind. Car sickness, boat sickness, game sickness. They're all very similar.
Only when you puke, it just floats away.
Yeah, that's the only difference. But, I mean, you're right, James. It is because of there's a disconnect between physical motion and brain expectations and, you know, ocular input. And you know, in space, there's some literal physical effects with semicircular canals and stuff, but basically they're all pretty much the same. And what you can do is, I mean, there's certain drugs you can take, you know, and then there's also a lot of training that can go into it. I mean, definitely they always say that, you know, the first time that you fly in space, almost everyone gets sick the first time. And then the second time, almost no one gets sick if you're lucky enough to go twice. So, I mean, there's a repetition aspect to it, you know, as your brain learns what to anticipate, it no longer becomes a problem. So I guess, you know, if I could have a conversation here with Mario as French from Toronto, I would ask, did you have the same problem with the other Metroid Primes? Do you have the same problem with other first-person shooters? Do you have the same problem with you know, third-person games like a Mario game or something like that? It's interesting that this particular game, and then also Metal Gear Solid 4, which seems very different from Corruption.
Well, you know, it could be, and this might be me extrapolating, is it possible that Mario is French recently got a new TV? Because I've heard of the refresh rate causing people to become ill.
Right, yeah. It could be the conditions. It could be the room is not lit well enough, and so, you know, basically you can't see things clearly enough. It could be the brightness needs to be turned up or something like that. You could be sitting too close to the screen. You could be playing it for too long of a period of time. There are a lot of things that you have control over that might help it. Then again, it could be a physical thing that it might be something that you could eventually work through just by repetition, but it might be so unpleasant to do so that it's not worth your time.
Yeah.
I could actually see this game doing it more so than the previous Metroid Prime games.
Just your point of view moves a lot more because you can aim on the fly and everything, I mean, and it moves faster.
The game is faster,
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
so I felt uncomfortable playing games after certain games because of stuff like this.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Not motion sick, but I have had times, and we saw this in the trilogy marathon that Nick and Chessa did, where, you know, like Nick was like, man, my arm was killing me after the first day because, you know, I'm sitting there holding this remote out, pointing it at the screen for hours and hours. And I had that experience with Corruption even, where my arm got tired.
I mean actual, you know, not dizziness, but like head. Like my head's just like, oh, okay, I need to stop for a little bit.
Or you might have been dehydrated or something.
It's possible.
Eat, but, James, eat.
I mean, it's tough for me to, in terms of answering the question, in terms of is there any kind of analogous kind of reasons or on a personal level, I can't think of any. I mean, motion sickness would probably be the only thing.
Yeah,
James fell asleep with SimCity, right?
That's not out of the game.
I guess that could be described as a game design issue.
And the game kept playing itself, though, so that might not count.
I have almost made myself sick playing games, like, just ill, because I played them so much and I didn't sleep, I didn't eat or drink, I didn't go out, I didn't get any exercise, you know. I've been so lethargic from playing games that it kind of made myself sick and I kind of had to, you know, get away from it for a while.
I've got plenty of memories of playing video games ill, as I'm sure many people do, because if you're very ill, it's the only thing you can do if you're bedridden.
It makes me feel better.
I actually do have one. If we recall, after I started reviewing King of Clubs, I came down with the worst flu I've ever had in my life.
What a surprise.
Remember, I was bedridden for like 3 days.
There's an obvious causal relationship.
I think that was like an autoimmune disease. It sensed you were playing a terrible game and attempted to kill your own body to save it.
I guess to get back to the question a little bit, I remember, you know, like I said, back when things like Doom first came out, I remember a lot of people saying they couldn't play it because it made them motion sick. And I think, I find anecdotally at least, it's much less common to hear that now. And I think it's just because we've been exposed to these kinds of experiences over a period of time. And also, I think that now, you know, people who come into games now kind of grew up with games, and so mm-hmm. they've been exposed to them their entire lives, and so it's not... it's not a wrenching kind of change. And I mean, you know, you hear things like people go to movies, 3D movies, and it makes them very uncomfortable to watch movies with 3D glasses on. And I think part of that's because it's not something you do very often. It's such yeah. a bizarre sensory input that, you know, it's kind of hard to take in. And so, you know, if I had grown up watching every movie with 3D glasses on, it probably wouldn't...
You'd just get acclimated after a
yeah,
while.
Yeah, exactly. These are the kinds of things that you really can get acclimated to. And again, it may be...
I guess the interesting thing is if you put stock in the whole thing about Japan and
exactly.
first person shooters, you know, the idea that they are more predisposed to suffer from it. So there may be a sort of fundamental aspect there about the people, but at the same time, if they become less common in the culture, then people are less exposed to them and then they're
right.
less likely to get acclimated. So it's both things working in concert.
Yeah. Obviously, I don't have any scientific thing to back this up on, but my speculation would be that there is no genetic reason that the Japanese people can't play those games. It's that they're not used to them because those games are not popular.
Well, you can be more
genetically
predisposed to motion sickness. So, I mean,
it could be. We haven't actually proven that it's genetic. It's just individual. It could be genetic. We don't know. Anyway, yeah, this guy actually got pretty technical there in that discussion, but definitely the first thing to do, first suggestion for Mario's French is, like we said, change up your conditions a little bit, check your TV, check your settings, check your lighting, check your distance from the screen. These things could all play into it, and also maybe try playing in shorter bursts of time. That may help as well, because we definitely want you to experience these games if it's possible to do so. All right, well, the next letter is from Tween in Connecticut, who writes, I have completed all three Metroid Prime games, and after I found Corruption to be one of the best gaming experiences I've ever had, I was really looking forward to the Metroid Prime Trilogy release. I'm now in the middle of the original Prime, and I'm really enjoying it for the most part. I do have one comment. It is darker than I remember, and I've been having a hard time seeing some of the detail in the game. I wonder if anyone else had noticed this, and if it might be the result of the resizing of the image for widescreen. I am loath to play too much with the brightness setting on the TV, because all my other images are fine. There's a really simple answer to this question. There's actually a brightness setting in Trilogy that you can set independent, and that way you won't have to mess with your TV. I mean, it's in the options menu, which is maybe something that you didn't jump into or didn't explore very much, but it's in there, and I think play around with that. You'll probably fix this problem.
It's actually a pretty common thing in games now, and I think most games that aren't garbage will have it from now on, as with LCD screens, it's a little bit less predictable how bright the TV is going to be than it was
yeah.
with just regular old TVs.
That's the other thing, is this person probably originally played Metroid Prime on a different TV than you are now. So if you've upgraded your TV since 2002, which is quite likely, then, you know, it's going to have completely different settings. It may not display blacks as well or whatever. And so, yeah, if you don't want to mess with your TV settings, most games, including Trilogy, have in-game settings, so you can fiddle with that until it looks
and
good.
And to go back to our previous question, it's important to have that stuff set right, because it can do things like it can affect your eye strain. And
absolutely.
Your, yeah.
So it's important to set that up right for your TV and right for you personally. It may not be the same for anybody else who plays it. But
all right. Greg has the next letter.
So this is Ryan from Anaheim, and he writes, there was a time when I never considered buying a non-Nintendo platform. Nintendo 64 delivered some of my all-time favourite games, and I was satisfied with what GameCube had to offer. But I've become a multi-platform owner now that the PS3 has hit $299. Finally, I don't need to settle for the Wii's third-party table scraps. Nintendo probably isn't concerned for the PS3 price drop because they're still selling better than ever, but I think there's something seriously wrong when previously die-hard loyalists like me are straying. I believe Nintendo will stay the course, but how do you think they should proceed from here? P.S. My PSN username is Ridley Saria. My friends list is empty, and I could always use an opponent in Burnout Paradise or Street Fighter 4.
Step up, homie. Mr. Diamond J. That's all I got to say.
Yeah, there you go.
If I ever get borderline competent with Street Fighter 4, I might attempt to take it online.
I'm awful. Yeah. Awful, dude.
I'm so glad that both of you play this on the PS3.
I don't even go online. I'm so terrible.
I would. Oh, it's my one opportunity to embarrass somebody on the show, and you both have the wrong system to play it on.
Yeah, so this is an interesting question, I suppose, in terms of, you know, what should they do. Although, the first thing I'd like to say is they're not selling better and better.
Right. Wii sales have gone down a lot this year.
They're flattening out a bit, which, rather than just looking at the raw numbers, you can look at the disappearance of Wii Play from the top 10 of the NPDs to tell you that.
There you go.
So they're not selling better and better, which is not in any way a surprise, considering, you know, the economic conditions, kind of, you know, slower time of year for software releases at some point.
Yeah, the system's age. I mean, it's still
selling. And they've already sold so many. I mean, there are fewer people to sell them to.
Right.
Would you like to buy a second one? It's identical to your first one. It just means you have to re-enter all your friend codes again.
And as we kind of talked about, you know, quite a few episodes ago, something like Wii Sports Resort, fine game, seems to have sold very, very well, big success, but it was never going to move hardware. It is a sequel to a game that everyone already has. I mean, you know, it's going to appeal to the same.
I mean, it moves hardware, but the hardware it moves is Motion Plus.
You know, that little Wii Sports game, exactly. Yeah, fuck that, but I'm going to get this Wii Sports Resort. I mean, no.
It's not something that's going to push a lot of people over the edge, you know, in the same way. Something like Wii Fit appeals to a whole different range of people on a whole different basis.
Yeah, now Wii Fit Plus may move Wii hardware.
Might.
No, I don't think so.
Very marginal,
I think it's, that again is something that may be a marginal effect. But, you know, so Nintendo have run out, for the time being at least, of those games that offer some kind of different kind of experience that reaches out to a completely different crowd that therefore can really move the needle on hardware. So the question becomes, I guess, do they think if they do cut the price, it will make that much of a difference? I mean, the one thing we know is that they have been for a very long time the best position to make a price cut.
Because they haven't made one yet.
And, you know, it's been well over a year since Nintendo lost the price leader status. I mean, Xbox 360 Arcade has been $200 for quite a while in the U.S., mm-hmm. And you know, that didn't move Nintendo. So PS3 going from 400 to 300, it's still more expensive than Wii. I don't see that being the motivating factor, but I think there may be other factors that push.
Yeah,
Nintendo
like the overall health of the economy, I guess, is one such issue. And the other such issue is, well, perhaps, you know, you think you may have kind of exhausted, you know, or come close to running up to exhausting its potential at a certain price point. Maybe it's time to move on after, you know, a good 3 years, perhaps. Sure. But it will be on their own terms, indeed. I just don't see
isn't everything.
Yes, exactly.
Well, to get to another part of the question, I guess, for Ryan, you know, Ryan seems to be almost ashamed or sad about the fact that he has to go out now and buy a PS3 to satisfy his urge for games. And personally, I say, you know, as a longtime multi-platform gamer, I say congratulations. I mean, don't feel that it's a bad thing. It really shouldn't. I mean, you should go out and if you can afford to do so, if you have the time and the money to play other systems, you should do that, because they're really cool experiences, regardless of, you know, and that's not to say that Wii is underpowered, or, you know, it just can't live up to expectations, or it's, you know, it's underperforming in this area or that area, or it doesn't have the games that I want to play. Just, there are at the very least exclusives for other systems that are worth playing. So I would say you will expand your mind, you'll expand your experiences, you'll get to play a lot of cool games that you wouldn't get to play otherwise. So I say congratulations on your purchase. I actually just today bought a PS3 myself. I had an Xbox a year ago. I've had other systems before that. And I say there's nothing bad about it. There's nothing to be ashamed about, and it doesn't necessarily mean that Nintendo has done something wrong.
Especially, I mean, this generation, in terms of what Nintendo's done, it's been about, you know, differentiating themselves from the other consoles of offering a different kind of experience that, at least hypothetically, could be very complementary to what you get on the HD consoles.
Wii 60, right?
Yeah, there was a lot of talk about that in the early going, and there's definitely, you know, plenty of merit in that, I think. I mean, from my point of view, someone who comes with a slightly different background from yours, because this is my PS3 is the first non-Nintendo Nintendo console I've had in 17 years.
And once again, congratulations to you as well.
But for me, it's in no way. What Ryan is saying is essentially is an expression of his dissatisfaction with the Wii. From my point of view, this is not that at all. I mean, I'll probably still game most on the Nintendo platform because I play mostly Nintendo games. But yeah, but it, for me, it's just the Blu-ray, the value, and there are a certain number of games that you would like to play that aren't on the Nintendo system. So it's not, again, it's more of a complementary sort of thing. So yeah, I mean, Nintendo have gone in a different direction. So obviously, I think there are a certain amount of people that find themselves that sitting less comfortably in what Nintendo provides than they used to. But in general, I don't think the quality has gone downhill or anything like that.
I think being concerned with Nintendo's direction as a company, I mean, I think most of the hand-wringing that goes on over things like this, it really only matters if you're into system wars and shit like that. You know, if you're a loyalist in the sense that, like, you actually care more about the company than you do about the games. I mean, I would say, it may very well be that Nintendo's going in the direction where at least half of the games they put out I have no interest in. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't mean that I can't still buy their Mario and their Zelda and their Metroid games when those come out. I've got plenty of games. I'm about to own all three current consoles, which is frightening.
Yeah, good luck. Good luck, Johnny.
I know, I'm really worried. But, I've got plenty of stuff to play, and so I think this mostly pisses off people who only in the past or in the present have only owned Nintendo systems, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, these are the people who have the most to lose from Nintendo branching out or diverting some of their development resources. Otherwise, I would say, if Nintendo puts out a game that I don't care about, like Wii Music, I don't have to buy it, and I'm not gonna buy it. And, if that sends a message to them or not, whatever. I don't vote with my dollars. I buy the games that I want to play, and I play them.
Yeah, well, but I mean, in terms of the text of the question, it seems like his major beef here, Ryan, is with the third-party stuff, not what Nintendo's
doing.
Well,
yeah, the third-party offerings on the Wii, with the exception of Xseed, who's been phenomenal.
I guess the intriguing thing about that is the idea that it's somehow so much worse than it was on GameCube and N64.
No, but it should be better.
In general, I think it's better than it has been in the past. But again, I think the people who are single system owners and consider themselves like very active, very core gamers, however you want to say it, gamers, I think they're now dependent more on third-party releases because Nintendo has moved away from their interests. And so they're really, very dependent, whereas in the past they weren't. I mean, in the N64 days, people, the third-party support was really bad for N64.
It was
awful. But a lot of Nintendo fans didn't care that much because Nintendo was releasing a game every 1 or 2 months that was really good.
Well, that Rare cranked stuff out
well,
as well.
Well, Nintendo put out a Megaton game every four to six months. I mean,
yeah, they had a pretty damn consistent schedule back in those days. And so the lack of third-party support, I mean,
it still wasn't. It wasn't exactly that numerous. I mean,
well, the third-party support on the N64 was god awful.
No, I mean, just if you were buying the big ticket items from Nintendo and Rare, you weren't stacking up a huge collection of games.
The game, yeah,
exactly.
And that's really where I got at that point because I mean, I was 14. I didn't have a job, so I was only getting the big ticket games, and there would be the quiet times. And then when I got a lot of reading done, it was essentially marathoning that game for 3 to 4 days straight because I was in such I hadn't played a new experience in so long.
But that's another thing though, isn't it? I mean, I think you look at the N64, especially the sparseness of the games. It might well have fit in with people, considering they were expensive, and if you were younger at the time, you wouldn't have exactly had latitude to spend like crazy on games. It suited you fine, whereas if you're now older and you've got disposable income and games are quite a lot cheaper, you feel like you want to spend all this money on games, but maybe you don't see all those games are there on the Wii to spend it on. But you're not really comparing like with like. It's a bit of an apple
and
oranges.
And that's really where I am. So I basically, at one point, I had to cut myself off in terms of buying games because I was not because I was spending too much money, but because I was finding myself I would have games stacked on top of each other to play. So I would say, all
right, that's where I'm at right now. Yep.
Yeah. And it's kind of a holdover from the N64 era, which it was, I have a game coming out in 6 months. I have to buy that game day one because it is scheduled time to buy that game.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I would say that if you suffered through the N64, this would be the hardest it could be to say, okay, I'm going to go multi-platform now, because you went through what might be the worst game drought of any console that just didn't die.
You've got the
die.
Tattoos to prove it, and now you're like, damn it, I don't want to give Sony any money. Look, don't feel bad about it. You're going to have a good time with these other games, and you still have your Wii. So when Nintendo does put out games that you're excited about, you can still play them. You haven't lost anything. You've only gained. Well, you've lost some money, but you've gained games, and you've gained happiness and relief from all your angst. And now all four of us will be multi-platform gamers, and we work for a Nintendo website and do a Nintendo podcast, you know? It's okay.
Johnny is the worst AA council leader. It's okay.
It's okay.
It's not a sin.
Have just a couple more drinks. Just a couple more.
Admit you have a problem, and I'll give you this vodka.
All right. Well, John has the final letter this week.
All right, the final one. KDR writes, I'd like to give a shout-out to Glory Days 2 for the Nintendo DS, probably one of the most obscure games I'm a fan of. The box bills it as a combination between RTS and shmup, but while it has the RTS part, 2D build a unit and it marches automatically, calling the action part a shoot-em-up is a bit of a stretch. It's more like 2D dogfights. So the game is a bit like Swords and Soldiers with its RTS aspect, except instead of casting magic spells to support your troops, you fly a plane or a helicopter and bombard enemies, airdrop infantry, and rescue civilians. As you can imagine, a game like that would probably work best in multiplayer, and it has support for up to 8 players, 12 including bots, divided into 2 teams and fighting it together with different roles for planes and helicopters and all that. The game's downfall is that regard is that it's a DS game with only local multi-cart multiplayer, and it's a pretty obscure game, so I doubt many people got multiplayer matches going, especially full team matches. I see copies in stores for very little money, so maybe 2 friends could pick up a copy each and give it a try. I heard it was developed by one man, which is quite impressive.
Wow, that is amazing if one person made a DS game.
Yeah.
It's funny.
I don't know that I've ever heard of that.
Because I almost bought this game on my last, you know, 2 weeks, time to go buy a game, because I just saw it.
You saw Glory Days 2 in the bargain bin, huh?
It's got a very odd-looking cover to it. For a minute, I thought there's 3 characters on the cover. For a minute, I thought 2 of them were clones of each other, but I guess that's not the case.
I remember when this came out, and I remember it getting really good reviews, and I remember the reviews saying, it's too bad this game will not sell because it has cool multiplayer and it's a lot of fun. Comparing it, you know, KDR compares this to Swords and Soldiers, which is a really good WiiWare game that I enjoyed a lot. So it's tempting. I mean, if I saw it really cheap, maybe I would check it out.
I mean, I remember hearing good things, but it's a classic sort of problem with DS multiplayer in many respects, isn't it? You know, this more multi-card problem.
It's a huge problem.
They don't have a certain kind of critical mass like a Pokemon. You know, where you obviously something like Pokemon, you don't really need to worry. There will be other people to play with, presumably.
And it's online too. So
and it's online as well.
Cover their bases.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. He doesn't mention it having any kind of download play. I mean, even if it did, it would probably be limited.
Yeah.
But you know, I'm assuming it doesn't from what he says.
It doesn't.
So it's just
And you know, for a lot of games, download play, you know, single card multiplayer, I guess you could also call it.
Yeah.
It's not really feasible because you know the DS has a limited amount of RAM and you have to fit the entire demo, which is basically what you're sending to someone else, or the entire client. You have to be able to fit it in that memory because it doesn't have any offboard storage. So, you know, there are just certain kinds of games that it's not really reasonable to expect that they could turn it into a single card download experience. And, you know, it's one of the problems. And I think, you know, it's something that Nintendo really should have handled better with their experience going through GBA. Because with Game Boy Advance had the same problem, really, in that it did support single cartridge multiplayer. But it's such a limited feature that it wasn't supported very much. And also, you know, a lot of developers and publishers were kind of worried about using it because they were afraid if they made it too good, then they would only be able to sell, you know, a fraction of the copies that they would normally be able to sell.
That's the problem, isn't it? It's a complicated relationship, isn't it, though? Because in the one sense, if you feel that you'll never be able to play a multiplayer because someone else won't buy it, then you won't buy it.
I tend to believe that very few sales have ever been lost to the single card or single cartridge multiplayer being too good. I think that's an overly conservative philosophy, and it's very similar to what Nintendo says about demos. You know, they don't, at least back in the old days with Yamauchi, they didn't want to give out demos because they felt like they were just, you know, if people had a free version of the game, even if it's very limited like a demo, they won't go out and buy it. And that's really not the case.
That's an important point because it does show you Nintendo's sort of philosophy about it, I guess, which must have some kind of trickle-down effect on the whole platform kind of environment.
It does. Because the platform isn't, the hardware isn't really designed to facilitate these kinds of things. Like, it may be there as an option, but it's not supported very well.
I mean, I definitely think it's, you know, with multiplayer sort of leverage games, if you can have appropriately balanced, and obviously in some cases it may not be technically feasible, so that's the issue, but appropriately balanced single card game, you want it to be, you know, an appetizer. You want it to be to entice people to buy the game and to, you know, get a bit of a word of mouth going. But what you end up with something like this with Glory Days is that you probably have to kind of buy it as a joint venture. Really,
you got to go out and buy multiple copies. And how many people are going to do that?
Very few.
Glory Days 2. Sounds like a Bruce Springsteen parody album or something. Is there a Glory Days 1?
Glory Days. I mean, has anybody ever even heard of that? You by.
Do, 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 do.
The wind coming on, girls.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I'm guessing it must have, decent amount. From what I've read, I think it must have some value in one player, otherwise it wouldn't have got the scores that it did.
Yeah, I'm probably sure it does.
Probably.
Because, you know, I mean, it's a tricky kind of situation in terms of how much do you factor in, you know, how good something is in theory and how good it is in practice. In that sense, in terms of like, well, you know, the multiplayer would be great, but good luck with you ever actually doing it.
And I've run into that problem on reviews before. It's just like, never play this multiplayer because nobody on their earth is going to buy Dungeon Explorer because it's boring as shit.
Hearing about games like this, it makes me wonder what goes through the minds of the developers when they're probably putting in a lot of effort to program this and design this multiplayer mode, that if they really step back and were, you know, realistic with themselves, they'd have to say, honestly, it's not worth the effort to develop this. And yet they do it anyway, and I wonder if it's just for their own enjoyment so they can play it in posterity. Is it for like they perceive there being like a really hardcore small group of people who will truly appreciate the effort that's gone into it, or are they just delusional and they think if we make this multiplayer really good that maybe this game will catch on?
I guess it's aspirational as much as anything. I mean, you know, at some point it's kind of like, well, if we accept defeat that it's not going to sell, you know, I mean, that's the kind of, I mean, it may well be the rational thing to do, but it might be quite difficult to do that.
Yeah. Well, anyway, I guess the silver lining here is that things like the DSi, which has a lot more RAM than the original DS, or the DS Lite, for that matter, things like single-card download play are perhaps, you know, with DSi-exclusive games, more feasible because you can transmit more data and the other system can hold more of that data. But then you run into the problem because the platform base is so segmented now with original DS and Lite and now DSi. Do you make a DSi exclusive game with really robust single card download play that can only be used by other DSi owners? I mean, it gets into really tricky areas.
That whole issue of DSi exclusive games is kind of fascinating. I mean, there have been reports floating around about, you know, that the end of the year you're going to see some.
Yeah, I just wonder, is that, it seems like a terrible idea.
I'd be thoroughly intrigued to see what they are, you know, who they're aiming at, you know, and how they sell. Yeah, because you are so much cutting yourself off. You're cutting yourself off of such a massive customer base that is the rest of the DS-owning population.
Mm-hmm. Right. Because, I mean, the DSi has been, I guess, successful so far, but it hasn't been crazy, like, oh my god, we got to go get one. Like,
I mean, it's been particularly successful when you look at it from the point of view that it's almost like a de facto price hike in the middle of a recession.
Exactly.
I think it's been pretty damn successful.
I think the sales of DSi so far reflect the stopgap measure that it is. And it makes the prospect of DSi exclusive software all the more bizarre.
I guess the point is that I can't really see anyone other than Nintendo doing it.
Right.
But then if it is Nintendo doing it, I'm just fascinated to see what it is that they have to use the DSi for.
And it won't be before the end of the year, because Nintendo doesn't. They don't pounce out games on such short notice, at least not in America. They might in Japan. That is more common in Japan.
In Japan, well, an excite.
Yeah. All right. Well, very interesting topic there. And Glory Days, too. I appreciate the shout-out, KDR. And we've been getting other shout-outs as well. I will say, if you want us to, you know, to read your letter and talk about some game that most people may not know about, be sure to include enough content in your letter that we have some justification for reading it. If you just kind of mention a game, we're probably not going to go do the research for you. So if there's a game that you really love and you want more people to know about it, explain why. You know, give us something to go on here, something we can talk about. And KDR did a great job with that. I also want to mention that a lot of the letters we get, maybe even the majority of them, include some very, very nice comments about our podcast. And people tell us, you know, they really appreciate it and they love what we do. And please continue to send that stuff. It's great. And we almost always cut that out when we read it on the air, and I just want people to know it's not because we don't appreciate it or we don't think it's appropriate or anything. It's really just in the interest of time, and you know, for everyone's sake, we leave those out when we read them on the air, but I do want to say we appreciate it, and I don't want anyone to feel slighted by the fact that we don't put them on the show itself. So yeah, that's going to wrap up Listener Mail for this week. Please send your letters to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. There's also a link in the article on the website, so you can always go there if you forget the address or you whatever. If you just feel like doing that, you can go to the website and send it that way. And please keep sending in the letters. We've had some really great ones lately, and it's exciting. It's an important part of the show, and we need your participation to do it. And since we're going on hiatus next week, we'll take just 1 week off for a little vacation for us.
I'll kind of miss it. I don't know.
Yeah, it's going to be weird, actually, taking a week off. We don't do it very often. Nope. It's usually once or twice a year at the most.
The thing is, you really do get into, you know, the routine of having this every single Thursday.
It is a key part of my life. And yeah. Greg, more than anyone. Well, anyway, so because we're taking hiatus, I'll just take a moment to say thank you, everybody, for listening to the show. And while we take a week off, you can use that time to go to iTunes and give us a little rating and maybe a review if
It'll
you
take
have anything
all
to
week.
Say.
Check out episode 103, definitely.
Yes, agreed.
There you go. There's your recommended re-listen there.
Your homework.
Yep.
Well, in all seriousness, please do, you know, if you have iTunes, please do go look us up on there and leave some nice comments, because it actually helps bring in a lot of new listeners. In fact, we have reason to believe, although not hard evidence just yet, that in the past few weeks and maybe the past couple of months, we've gotten a lot of new listeners.
We have grainy film indicating.
So, of course, welcome to all of you. A lot of you have been writing in, and we've been reading your letters, and it's great to hear from you. And so, you know, you can help spread the love and increase the community of Radio Free Nintendo.
See, I think we should everybody should leave with a word of wisdom for our listeners. You can just go around the table like John, what's your word of wisdom for
my word of wisdom?
Yeah,
I don't know. It's easy to take cheap shots from the cheap seats. That's
what
I got.
We do, John. Okay. You just completely degraded the entire podcast.
That's all I got, man.
Nice. All right, here you go. Here's a bit of Marv Levy for you. If it's too tough for them, it's just right for us. There you go. That's why we lost 4 Super Bowls.
I'll do you one better, Greg. I'll go with JFK. We go to the moon not because it is easy, but because it is hard.
Oh, they're very, very nicely done. But I think I've got all of you.
Yeah, and that's a paraphrase. Sorry.
All right, so I'm gonna go up one up all of you and just note that a day without sunlight is like nighttime.
Oh my god. That's awesome. All right, bye.
Bye.
See you in 2 weeks.
Later.
Peace out. It's like The World Ends With You. That is a like straight up DS game. Let's use every feature and make it really complicated. And
now breathe into the microphone.
You have to do three things.
Don't
at
blow.
Once.
Breathe. Damn it. Breathe.
Well, I was gonna say there hasn't been a CPR simulator for DS. I guess there's some of that in Trauma Center.
You know what we need? We need something better than that. We need a game that is literally a CPR simulator. That's it. It's the whole game.
Like My CPR Coach.
I'm honestly surprised that hasn't been released.
If you could mail in and get your certification, that'd be pretty sweet.
Mail in? Yeah, because playing on a DS would be just like playing it in reality.
Yeah, well.
I'm expecting it to come from, like, Majesco anytime soon.
Yep, definitely Majesco. We'll call it CPR Mama. We should move on.
I was trying to make a joke about the robot from Rocky IV. But
oh,
I just
the robot! Brilliant.
See, I gotta watch Rocky IV. I forget about that. I just remember Ivan Drago.
And it has I must break you. The robot has a little sort of romance with Paulie, which is just wrong.
Wow.
Oh yeah, in Rocky's mansion, right?
Yeah.
Oh
yeah.
God.
Originally, it was going to be subtitled or How Rocky Balboa Brought Down the Iron Curtain, I think.
Because once the whole part with the fight, once he goes to the Soviet Union, it's over.
Oh, it's brilliant. He's running up the mountain.
Yes. And the whole training sequence, it's par excellence, I swear.
So he's running up the mountain and Drago's running up the treadmill or whatever, you know, and then
yeah.
he's lifting up a wooden cart, Drago's getting juiced, which of course is really ironic now.
Yeah.
Like, I think last time I watched that movie, I went on 30 minutes about the high top fade that Drago's sporting.
Yeah.
I love that movie so much.
You could change. Everybody could change.
Rocky!
He got faux Gorbachev loving it.
Oh, God.
I will
like,
tear
like, if
down
that actually
this
happened,
wall.
Everyone in that crowd would have been liquidated. I mean, let's be honest.
Oh, man. Are we still talking about video games?
I think we've got enough stinger material here.
So, football,
Rocky
IV.
Rocky.
You know, Russians don't roll their R's nearly that much. Sorry.
There's a lot of things that don't happen nearly as that much in Russia.
I just love the fact that when he's training, it's like he's training in like the middle of a Street Fighter game. You know what I mean? Like, that's about the mentality that they made that movie with. It's so great.
Yeah, I know. It's awesome.
Like, I'm expecting like Zangief to like jump out of like jump from behind like a snowbank.
It's like, all right, so I need to train for this fight. I'm going to go to Siberia to do
I know.
And not only that, but he runs up the top of the mountain and just goes,
set to your synth music.
It's so brilliant.
It is.
Oh. It's like they had to recreate the scene on the steps in Philadelphia. It's like,
what if it was a mountain?
Oh, God.
So, Greg, I did not even realize that Earthworm Jim 2 came out in Japan.
Yeah, I was like, this is so strange. This is weird.
Smooth transitions.
Ding, ding.
I've got one more. I've got one more word of wisdom. Richard! There you go.